Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, everyone. This is Carol Harnett. I'm the president of the Council for Disability Awareness. And I want to welcome you to the first ICA Educational Podcast Services show that includes the Council for Disability Awareness. This show is being done as a pair in conjunction, and we're so excited to have been invited to do this. Our topic today covers the story of what I'm going to call the Social Security Disability Insurance Advocacy Programs, and it will give listeners whether you are a person who works, whether you are an employer, or whether you're somebody who works in and around the area of Social Security assistance, SSDI, which is what Social Security Disability Insurance acronym is, or the larger, you know, industry around disability. It'll give you some good grounding on what SSDI is, what and where and how SSDI advocacy developed over time, and what the future may look for that platform. So our guest today, in addition to myself as the host, is Otis Darby. Otis is the founder and the president of Integrated Benefits, Inc., which is indeed one of the very first SSDI advocacy programs. And he is joined by his colleague, Matt Jensen, who is an executive vice president at IBI and also a member of the Council for Disability Awareness Board. Both of these gentlemen have really deep expertise in the area in and around disability benefits. Otis, of course, being more steeply deeped in, I just said that wrong, didn't I? Deeply in SSA, the Social Security Administration, and SSDI, and SSDI advocacy. And Matt has a background similar to mine in some ways, originating in the group benefits space, including short and long-term disability, FMLA, and SSDI advocacy. So we only have 30 minutes. I could go on and on about their background, but I'm going to laugh at myself and just say, let's get started. So welcome to both of you. And if given Otis's history, Otis, if you don't mind, we're going to start with you. And I'm going to ask you really the most basic question of all. What is Social Security Disability Insurance?
Well, hi, Carol. Happy to be here. And I think a short definition would be that it's a payroll-funded program to protect American workers, to provide income in the event of disability where they can't, they lose their earnings.
You know, this question actually just popped into my head. I feel like there are some people who understand what this program is, have heard of it, but I feel like the far majority of Americans have never heard of SSDI. Is that your experience as well?
Well, I think there is an element that is not aware that Social Security does more than just provide retirement benefits or survivors benefits. And, of course, I think there's a tendency to separate even Medicare from it. Disability was not part of the original Social Security Act that FDR enacted in the 30s. It was added, I believe, in the 50s. And initially, it was just retirement survivors. And Medicare, as most people know, was added in the 1960s. So, yes, there is a sense that, you know, what is the disability? How are you eligible for it? How do you file for it?
You know, you just asked the next question I was going to ask, which is, you know, who is eligible for this program?
Well, you have to have a connection to the workforce, and you have to have both a current connection, which is, I think a lot of people are familiar with the concept of 2040, 20 quarters in a 40-quarter period. But then you also have to be fully insured, which is defined as having at least one quarter of coverage, excuse me, for every year that you've worked after age 21. So somebody who, say, is 51 years of age, they have to have 20 quarters or 5 years of work in a 40-quarter, a 10-year period. But then they would also have to have 30 lifetime quarters since age 21 to 51, one quarter for each of those 30 years. So you have to be both currently and fully insured, and then you have to meet Social Security's very simple definition of disability, you know, an impairment that prevents work for at least 12 months or results in death.
Thank you for that clarification. And actually, as I'm listening, and I thought I knew a lot about SSDI, I realized I didn't know that second part of the eligible definition of having worked at least one quarter in those work years. So thank you for that. I will tell the audience that I will tell the audience that I actually did know what SSDI was when I was working, when I started working as a young person, which I think people are less likely to know about SSDI. But I did not know about SSDI advocacy until I left working in healthcare and direct patient care and moved to working for a disability insurance carrier. And that's when I found out about Social Security Disability Insurance Advocacy or Assistance. So I know you were involved pretty much on the ground floor of this. So when did you get involved and what made you want to get involved in this area?
Well, I think that I wanted to get involved in it because my Social Security career went into the Reagan-Donald Stockman era of the mid-80s, and I quit viewing federal employment. I was working for Social Security as an attractive occupation, so I started looking around for what can you do with a background in Social Security. And along with a coworker in the early 80s, we had discussed, kind of thought of things we might do if we wanted to leave Social Security. And we toyed with this idea of being an advocate. It started with something as simple as just maybe helping people through the retirement process, getting an earnings record, advising them as to whether or not they should take benefits at age 62 early, or at age 65 at that time, full benefits. And as we went forward over a period of several years with this, it evolved into advocating with insurance companies to help their long-term disability recipients to gain their Social Security disability.
Yeah, that's really helpful as a grounding. Because I think I didn't realize that I think particularly I'm trying to think back to 20 years ago when I first became aware of this. I didn't realize that it might be somewhat of a complicated process where you would need help to apply for SSDI benefits. Why do you think it is not something that is necessarily easily done by an individual?
The best answer to that, I think, Carol, is that when I worked for Social Security, and I did that for 11 years, starting as a claims representative, the intake worker for people coming in for disability, retirement, Medicare, whatever it might be, and then ending as a supervisor and as a manager with Social Security. But as a claims worker, I would frequently encounter people coming in to file for disability, and invariably you ask them, why are you filing, meaning what is your disability? And over again, people would say, well, because my insurance company is making me file. And that was kind of a red flag that, well, this person doesn't want disability. That was my perception as a Social Security employee. They're just being required to come in by their insurance company. So you would write that in remarks on the application, that when asked why they were filing, because their insurance company required it. And I think that sent the wrong message all the way through the process. So, you know, someone starting out like that is already off in a bad direction. And so the process itself, while it has, you know, simple definitions, they'll tell you that you know, the definition of disability is just a few sentences, and the process is a five-step sequential evaluation, which is, you know, are you working? Do you have a severe impairment? Does that impairment meet or equal a listing? If not, does it prevent your past work? And if it does, then the fifth step and final step is, does it prevent any other work? And so it seems very simplistic, but in reality, you know, there are just reams and reams of regulations and rules that govern how those things are evaluated and decided.
Yeah, as you describe it, I mean, I imagine even for people listening, they're going, oh, I get why I might need help. And I know when I did work on the group disability side, the side you often partner with, and if not very often partner with in this process, there was an understanding around, particularly around people who worked in claims, that it was harder to qualify for SSDI benefits than it was to receive a long-term disability benefit, or on the individual side, an individual disability benefit. What, you know, you've kind of started to spell it out in your description of the five. What makes it harder to qualify for SSDI than it does for long-term disability?
The biggest thing there, Carol, is that with long-term disability, it's usually your own occupation. If you can't perform your occupation, then you're eligible for long-term disability, maybe just for a 2-year or 3-year period, and then you might transition mm-hmm. to any occupation. But with disability, Social Security disability, it's in any occupation. So if you're under the age of 50, that's a milestone age within Social Security, what they call a younger individual, you have to be disabled not only for your job, but for any job that might exist in significant numbers. When you're 50 to 55, closely approaching advanced age in Social Security's language, then there may be some exceptions. You know, they're going to look at your exertional level of your past work, what limitations do you have now. They'll look at the skill level of that work, unskilled, semi-skilled, skilled, and they'll apply these vocational factors as to what kind of a transition you might be able to make to other work. So Social Security is a lot more technical definition right from the beginning, the get-go, for anyone filing. And so there's good reason for that common perception that Social Security is more difficult to attain, because it is.
Yes. So thank you for that clarity, because, again, I think for people who are listening, they don't understand the breadth and depth of the definition. And I often think, as someone who's spent a lot of my career, even on the healthcare side, working with employers in trying to either help keep their employees at work if they experience an injury or illness, or return them to work, employers that don't offer disability benefits, meaning group disability benefits, the insurance product, which can be a benefit, particularly if the employer pays some or all of the premium, they just think it may be a simple process for their employees to apply for SSDI. And I think in both employers and individuals gain insight from your explanation. Now, you know, earlier you referenced something which I know to be true as well in my experience, particularly talking with people who are receiving some form of disability benefits, particularly long-term, which is the belief that the only reason why they're applying for SSDI benefits is because they're required to by their insurance carrier. But there are benefits beyond that requirement that exist associated with being approved for SSDI benefits. Can you help people understand why anyone would want to apply for SSDI benefit, not just for the income replacement piece?
That's an excellent point, Carol, and it's something that I didn't appreciate as I first went to work as an advocate for people in this, that it was a common, a pervasive misconception within Social Security. And in the early years, that was the largest hurdle advocates faced, was educating Social Security to the fact that the insurance companies were not the party at interest in this person's filing for Social Security disability. The individual had a great deal at risk and a great deal to benefit getting that Social Security award. The foremost thing, I think, is health insurance, Medicare. In order to be eligible for Medicare, you have to be disabled for 24 full months. And many people in the long-term disability process understand that the health insurance workers have will drop typically after 12 months, and then they can get this COBRA extension. If they get a Social Security disability award, they can get a COBRA extension that will continue their private health insurance right up to 29 months when Medicare would begin. I said 24 months. There's a five-month waiting period for disability coupled with the 24 months is 29 months to get Medicare. So that's a huge thing, for, obviously, for someone who's disabled to have health insurance going forward. Another thing is that they will get cost of living increases from Social Security that many long-term disability policies, if not most, do not provide for cost of living increase. So that's a, you know, these 1%, 2% of recent years doesn't seem like much, but even those over a 5 or 10 year period add up. But I was working for Social Security in the late 1970s, and I can recall a 14% increase during the harder years, early Reagan years, when inflation was rampant. And, you know, 9%, 14% cost of living increases. So there have been periods in our history where it's been more than these little 1% or 2% cost of living adjustments. And thirdly, and perhaps most importantly for the individual, if they don't think they have a stake in this, is that if you're out of work due to disability, your earnings record, if you don't file for and obtain Social Security disability, be approved, then all those years, say you go out of work at age 50, and now, you know, you have to be 66 to get, well, 62 for your earnings record, your retirement, early retirement to kick in, you have 12 years there that your earnings record is still running, so to speak. And those are all 0 years. So when it comes time to calculate your retirement benefit, you know, you think you have long-term disability, that's going to provide you income to retirement. Then you go in at age 62 or whatever age to get that retirement, and you're going to find out that those 12 years that you weren't working are all going to be 0 years used in that calculation of your retirement benefit. So roughly then one-third, because they'll use 35 years, one-third of those years will be 0 years, and that's going to have a profound impact on the amount of money you have in retirement.
Yeah, and to me, that, you know, the both the health and actually all of them are important for different reasons, right? But when you think retirement, that's particularly when you still look at the number of people who rely so heavily on Social Security retirement when they permanently leave the workforce. That's a huge benefit to have. You know, that adjusted in your years towards your retirement benefits. So, yeah, I can't say enough about how important I think all of these are. You know, you prompted as I was listening to you a question that I think you'll know the answer to, which is the COBRA extension that's available to people when they apply and receive SSDI benefits. One of the trends we have seen on the employer side since the Affordable Care Act went into place is employers encouraging their employees when they either, you know, when they leave employment, whether it's for disability or for other reasons, to consider, instead of taking COBRA for their health insurance, to enter the individual marketplace. You know, so to get benefits on their own for health insurance through the Affordable Care Act. If that happens
Absolutely.
To an individual, are they offered the same extension that they would be if they were on COBRA?
Yes. Yes. The thing is to have, I don't know if it's not the same extension, because COBRA is going back to your employer and saying, look,
right.
here's my Social Security award. It's dated within the first 18 months of me going out of work. And so I need this, you know, COBRA extension to take me to the 29th month. Whereas the Affordable Care Act, the person, well, the COBRA extension, I should back up, it can be prohibitively expensive, because what it is that
mm-hmm.
your employer
yeah.
has been paying the lion's share of your monthly cost of health care. Under COBRA, you have to absorb that entire cost. So for many people, particularly if there's a family covered under that plan, the premium can be $1,000 or more a month, and it's just prohibitively expensive for them. So they may have to go under the Affordable Care Act, where they can get a much more affordable, you know, wouldn't be the same coverage perhaps, but at least it's something they can afford and will cover them until they can get to that 29th month in Medicare. And
mm-hmm.
the family's kind of forgotten in this, where, you know, you typically or oftentimes have a worker who's providing the insurance for the entire family, the children, the spouse. And whether it's, you know, the Affordable Care Act, that would cover them. A COBRA would cover them. But at 29 months, Medicare doesn't cover them. Medicare is just
right.
a disabled individual. So they're going to face that harsh reality that their family benefit is going to be gone, you know, sooner or later.
Yes, yes. Thank you for that. It really helps. And apologies to listeners who are not as interested in the weeds as I am, but these are all such important factors for people to understand. You know, as I listen to you talk, you know, Otis, you're really passionate about this topic. And I'm curious, like, what makes you stay passionate about this work after, you know, doing it for so many years?
It's the feeling that you're working with an individual. I don't know how many times, as recently as just a few years ago, when I would talk with someone, you mentioned the Affordable Care Act, I would look up for them their insurance commissioner in their state so they could contact them about how to best proceed with health insurance going forward. I would give them the phone numbers of their U.S. senators or representatives, because frequently those offices would have somebody on their staff that would help people handle or navigate through the Affordable Care Act, you know, who to contact, how to check into
mm-hmm.
it. So it was always this sense with me that it wasn't numbers. When I worked for Social Security, I was a numbers guy. Everything was numbers, you know. What was my processing time? What was my accuracy? But when I transitioned into working directly with individuals, attending hearings with them, it became a sense that this is important to that person. I mean, this nothing is more important than having health insurance going forward, having income going forward. And you quickly realized how much it meant to the person, and you learned that it meant a lot to the insurance company. If you succeeded in obtaining an award of benefits for a person, the insurance company would be happy. And even the administration, the judges you would appear before, many of them would be appreciative of a case that allowed them to make the right decision, a favorable decision, that you obtained the evidence that was needed, you made their jobs easier. And I know that any of us that have done this for any period of time will have encounter judges who will actually thank you at the end of a hearing for preparing, you know, having the case well prepared so that they could make the right decision and have it be supported. So there was
mm-hmm.
always a tremendous sense of satisfaction when you would travel, you would meet someone face to face, because it becomes face to face at that point. It's not just a person on the other end of the phone. And when you know that you succeeded in gaining those benefits for them, that help going forward with their lives, and you've helped the insurance company, and you've helped the administration, because in the early years this was very much an education process to let the administration, the judges in particular, know that this wasn't about the insurance company. This was about that disabled wage earner.
Right.
So eloquently described, Otis. I really appreciate that, and I appreciate the work you did in being just such a pioneer in this work. And I'm looking up at the clock. I knew this would happen. Time's starting to fly, and I actually had another question to ask you, but we can't ignore this other expert we have on the phone, too. So, Matt, if you don't mind, I have a couple of quick questions for you, starting with how has the Social Security Administration handled applications in these last 10 months during the pandemic? Have they risen to the occasion? Have they had some stumbles?
Yes, sure. Well, thanks for having us today, Carol. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thank you for being here.
It's great. I feel like they've done a really good job in a very difficult spot. Like many businesses all over this country, the pandemic has hit, and finding ways to adapt and get through the process, I feel Social Security has done a very, very good job. I mean, basically they had to take all their existing staff and transform into a work-from-home situation. And when you look at numbers and you look at statistics this year, some things are down, like overall awards and applications are a little bit down this year. But how they were able to continue to do the day-to-day activities the entire year and continue to process cases was pretty extraordinary. So I feel like they did a really, really good job.
Yeah, that's great. And I have learned that, frankly, from talking to you guys at IBI. So thank you for that. And, you know, I know it's hard almost right now, at least for me, to think too far into the future, given we're in a very similar situation that we were in 10 months ago. But when you think about the SSDI application beyond the pandemic, you know, beyond as we get past this, how do you see it potentially improving even further or evolving as we move forward?
Yeah, sure. Well, I mean, I think they've already started to do some things from a technology standpoint. The pandemic has caused so for example, wet signatures used to be required on all applications. So an application would be sent to an individual and they'd have to put a wet signature on it. But in light of the current situation and keeping people home and not traveling to the post office, et cetera, they've eliminated that as a requirement currently. And I feel we've been on calls and we've heard from them. They're moving in a direction to be more technology-based. They've started video conferences for hearings now. So I feel like the direction that they're going is a positive one. You know, it's going to take some time to get through all of the changes that they're looking to do. But those two, for example, are things that they did on the fly. And they implemented it pretty quickly. And it's just those types of things as they move forward will be really important to the process.
Yeah, thank you for that. And just a quick question that just popped in my mind. Has the wait time been longer for people to be awarded, you know, as we've been in this current period?
Yeah, so we have seen some additional wait time, particularly at the initial level. I mean, the fact that they figured it all out, got people working from home and continued the process was a monumental step to begin with. But we have seen some slowdown in processing times, but nothing terrible. I mean, it's not too far off, but it's to be expected. You know, when I talk to folks all the time about this, it's certainly it's down, but it's not something that's earth shattering.
Thank you so much for that, Matt. I really appreciate it. And now that I'm looking at the clock, I see that we've got about 20 seconds to wrap this up. So you have to promise me, you guys, that we're going to talk again. And at this point, I'm going to say thank you. I'm going to say thank you. Thank you to ICA for letting us do this. Thank you to our wonderful guests, Otis Darby and Matt Jensen of Integrated Benefits, Inc. I'm Carol Hornett from the Council for Disability Awareness. We're wishing you good days ahead, and we're signing off. Thank you so much for listening.
Thank you, Carol.
Thank you.